Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference Podcast. This podcast features a session from the conference presented by Adam Honia, Provost for the University of Phoenix, and Angie McQuaig, Director of Data Innovation at Apollo Group Incorporated. Their session is entitled The Science of Education, Creating a Compelling Learning Experience.
The University of Phoenix started offering online degrees in 1989. We now have over 400,000 students. Approximately 100,000 of those students take classes in a ground campus setting. The rest are online students. So we've been working with people online since 1989. We've been doing assessment of our students since 1985 because our model was unique when it came out. And our regulators were very concerned about what we were doing. They're actually still very concerned. And today's presentation really isn't about learning assessment in the traditional sense. It's where we're moving to at this point. In the mid-90s, our online programs outgrew our on-ground programs considerably. So by 2000, we had large numbers of students enrolled in our programs and potentially large amounts of data. What we did with that data was pretty elementary. In part, that was because of tools. In 2002, we took all of our textbooks, probably 95%, to electronic books. At that time, we didn't have the current readers, and we had to farm our own department to do that. So we have some history with electronic materials. As we've moved into more recent years, we have fused the platforms that our students taking class on ground and our online students use so that all students use electronic materials, have a learning platform. What's interesting to me is I feel that most of higher ed has caught up to what we were doing. We had battles in the mid-90s about having an electronic library. That's a given now. In 2002, people didn't quite know why we would want all of our books in electronic format. And so historically, I felt that many times we were trying to explain why we were doing what we were doing. I consider us pretty well now, even with what other folks are doing, and we're trying to think of what is the next step for us. We have now lots of other institutions that are using learning platforms. We have other institutions that are using cloud computing. And to be truthful, we're just getting into cloud computing ourselves at this point. So I really feel that we're moving much more into a shared space than our previous alone space with technology and education. We have launched recently social networking. But what Angie's going to talk about next, I think, is the next generation for us. And it's what we really plan to do with data and what kind of data we plan to collect and what is the framework that we're going to collect that data in.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about where we'd like to be in the future. A lot of what we're presenting today is conceptual, and we are in the process of road mapping, and we want to be really transparent about that. So we won't get into a lot of technical detail about the architecture behind it. So, you know, as we said in the summary, the next generation of innovative learning platforms will be education as a service, cloud computing systems that are not just open and extensible, but are also supportive of highly social interaction among students and are highly individualized. And so we're going to talk a lot about that individualization today and how we get there, what some of the hurdles are that we're facing, and how we plan to surmount those. To be clear, our number one goal is to improve the learning experience for everyone. We're not out there seeking ways to plug technology to make our learning experience look more like other industries like the Googles and the Yahoos and the Amazons of the world. We're looking for tools that, based on our empirical research and the culling of the literature, will answer some of the questions that we have. In order to be able to really create these individualized pathways that I'll be describing today, and that you've all experienced in other industries, Kevin and I might have the exact same list of friends on Facebook, but because we have different interests and different knowledge bases, his homepage is going to look completely different than mine. His experience will be completely different than mine. And Facebook knows everything that we do, every click stream, everything that we type in. They know I'm vegan, so they give me great great advertisements about veganism, Kevin might not get that. So we've seen these kinds of innovations in shopping sites and all kinds of places. So what we really have to do now is really understand deeply our learners, everything about them. And we'll talk a little bit about what we're coining the Learner Genome Project. I happen to know Jim Watson, part of the Human Genome Project, as a personal friend, and he's not happy with my coining of the term. But it's important that we understand that in order to truly individualize and do it with the greatest degree of efficacy, we have to know absolutely everything that we can learn about our students. We're really inspired by the late Anne Brown of UC Berkeley, who has done a lot of ethnographic and fantastic educational research looking at students as they interact in classroom environments. We're looking to develop a model that we can form the learning platform that focuses on a very, very firm empirical basis. When we talk about using evidence from data-informed insights for continuous improvement, we're talking about a learning platform that learns. And so part of our design in the early days, and we are in early days, I just want to be clear about that, is designing platforms that both yield empirical evidence, because we do have one of the most generous sample sizes anywhere to be found. So we want to iterate on our data collection and be able to have the platform not only learn about learners, but learn about itself and just be continuously improving. And that said, we want to be able to give information back to learners so that they can continuously improve, so that our programs can continuously improve, etc. So it's a very systemic way of looking at improvement. This idea of building a very learner-centric environment, what Facebook has done so well, it's all about me on Facebook, right? There's no need to boost my ego. It's doing it for me, and I'm helping it by telling it everything about my life and posting pictures of everything in my life. We recently introduced a very wide-scale social network, which is also a professional network. It encourages people to share about themselves to other people who aspire with the same interests professionally and academically. So you're never alone. There are always people there to support you. Let's just tell a very quick story here. We've got Dorothy and Frank. Dorothy is a school secretary. She's been out of high school for a long time. She has come back to the University of Phoenix to seek a teaching degree. She's a pretty good student, an avid reader. She really, really puts in the time that she needs to put in. She's not very confident about her writing skill, which is a very important and pivotal skill in higher ed, right? If you can't write, you can't show us what you know about nuclear physics or whatever it is. And she's a big leader in class. So we see that about her. And as you're looking at these characteristics, be thinking about how you can measure them. How do you know this in an online learning platform? That's a big challenge of ours right now, is measuring these things in ways that we can act upon. So let's look at Frank. He's a police officer. In high school, he was a football player, which is the reason he stayed in school. His GPA was, 2.5. English is his second language. He really is devoted to helping kids, so he volunteers at the YMCA, and he wants to be a high school football coach. He's really having a tough time between his police work and his family to be able to get all of his homework done in school. So how might these two learner experiences in the very same individualized learning platform be different? This is what we're working on tackling. So among the hundreds of questions that are before us, here are just a few. What are our learners' goals? Everybody comes to with a different goal in mind. How much should we try to customize toward those goals? How should the curriculum be aligned with what the National Manufacturers Institute tells us are the skills that are needed out there? And how do we pull them in to help make learning experiences really be in keeping with your goals? If your major goal being at a university program is to set a fine example for your children, that's a slightly different than I want to be a certified teacher. Maybe it's both. How do we adjust the curriculum for each learner? What do students know? Sounds like an easy thing. But how do we measure all that they know to be able to apply to the actual coursework? Maybe Kevin and I'm going to pick on Kevin because he's close enough for me to read his name tag. Maybe Kevin and I are taking an economics class together. There are composite skills that help you succeed in an economics class. Graph reading is one good example. I may be very strong at graph reading, but I know nothing about economic theory, and that's actually true. I don't know about you, Kevin. Do you know very much about economics? He does. Great example. Are you a good graph reader? No, he's terrible. So he and I are going to come at an assessment wherein we need to read a graph about the domain of economics, and I might do well just because I know graph reading. So you see, a formative assessment might not be able to tell us all that we need to know about our composite skills. So this is a really important question. How do we know what they know and what the underpinning skills are and what they know about the actual domain? How do we know about their reading comprehension and their attitudes and their affective responses to learning? Those are terrifically important questions that we're really trying to tackle now. How do we model learners? If we want to individualize, it's helpful to create learner models. Frank, do you mind if I pick on you? Okay. Frank might come to us with, we're calling it cognitive DNA. We're getting really, really pretentious on our naming, but we're aiming high to fully understand what Kevin brings to the classroom, or Dorothy or Frank. And so if we can understand as much as possible about him, we'll be able to individualize. And we'll be able to put him in some groups, some types of students where the possibility or the probability of us choosing the right materials, pacing, assessments, formats, and user experience for him that will help to optimize his learning. Tons of other questions. How do we know that the guidance we give him that's individualized is going to even help him? It's not enough to assume it because we've read the literature. How do we measure success in this individualized platform? This is the most important question. It probably should be at the top. How do we do this cost effectively? I'm not going to talk about that today. Okay. So in our ILP, our individualized platform development, these are some of the things that we're really focusing on. That it be open in the sense that it can talk to third-party applications easily, that it's extensible, we can continue to add, and that there are many, many user options, as you see in other online sectors. That the platform is very collaborative, teams can get together and function well, functions like Google Docs and other kinds of tools that way that make it very easy to collaborate, and that that collaboration can be tracked and monitored so that it can be supported by our faculty. This one is interesting, that it is pedagogically and andragogically neutral, pedagogy being the science of teaching children and andragogy being the science of teaching adults and adolescents. What we mean by that is that the system is not designed only for constructivist faculty. It's not designed just for the more straightforward, didactic-leaning faculty members, but that it can be customized in a kind of iGoogle. I can move stuff around and it looks just the way I want it to look. So that's in part what we mean, so that any approach that you take as a faculty member or as a school or in a particular course, it's available for customization in that way. When we talk about content innovations, Kevin, Frank, or Dorothy, they each come to us with a complex set of learning modality preferences. Kevin, would you say you're visual, auditory, dominant? Auditory, okay. So if Kevin and I are taking an economics course together, I need a YouTube video. I'm going to learn best that way, but we're going to give Kevin a podcast so that he can download it to his iPod and, you know, as he's in line at Safeway, he can be listening and studying via his mobile device. So the idea here really is that the content needs to be rich enough, rejecting the one-size-fits-all model of presenting content online. And this is part of the resource drain, is how do we present lots and lots of different options for content formatting, and how do we make it state-of-the-art? What our objective there is just getting people to that aha moment using their own personalized pathway and preference, and also to get to the right Bloom's level. So, you know, all of the ideas in economics can be presented at the basic knowledge and comprehension levels, and then we want to have a range. So think about content development. Imagine that you have all of these considerations, background knowledge, modality preferences, content format preferences, and imagine that you need to create instructional materials to meet the needs of all of those different kinds of approaches and learner needs, and then imagine that you need to create them for each of the Bloom's levels. That's a big challenge to us. In order to individualize, we first understand the learner, and then we prepare the materials that we think will help them be most successful. Now we're starting to talk about our adaptive learning engine a little bit here, which is in the formative stages of being designed. That engine, of course, will sit on top of several things. One is Kevin's profile. What do we know about him? We'll talk about what some of the core elements of that are. And what do we know about the domain? So it'll also sit on top of a domain ontology, take economics for example. So we'll build a complex ontology representing all of the ideas and their relationships in economics. And on top of those two big buckets of information will be a rules engine that helps, based on Kevin's interaction with the system, will prescribe and or provide options that we think will be most conducive to Kevin's learning needs. Obviously, the priority will come into play when I think about what Kevin's intervention needs are. How do I develop an early warning system to understand how he's doing, and if he's not doing well, what's in my locus of control to help remediate or support him early before he struggles? As you know, in online courses, the pace is so fast. By the time you see that there's a problem, you've moved on to the next thing. So it's very important to us that we leverage a platform that hits things early and helps us understand and provides Kevin with all of the information he needs about his own level of achievement as he moves along. And then data-informed guidance. Our learning analytics director is right here in the orange shirt, Mike Sharkey. And so his big task, all of our big task, is really what kinds of data products need to be streaming out to all of these users in real time to be able to know how Kevin's doing, to be able to alert academic counselors, et cetera, faculty members like Adam, so that we understand how these products are working at a high level. When we started out on this journey, the group really set into place some very important core principles, and we'll talk about those quickly. Learning is a personal journey. So we all come, as I said, with different goals. We want to be able to have an experience that feels challenging enough for us and also somewhat natural for us, right? Everybody's been in a course where you feel like a fish out of water, and you're getting the same thing as everyone else is getting, and they're doing fine and you're not, or vice versa. But let's look at a quote. Carol Ann Tomlinson is, in the K-12 world, sort of the guru of differentiated instruction. She said, what we share in common makes us human. How we differ makes us individual. So, of course, the Higher Learning Commission says to us, this is the content you will teach. And the idea here is not that, you know, Kevin learns whatever the heck he wants about economics. It's that Kevin gets to the end goal, to the learner outcomes that are predefined and for which we are responsible in the way that suits him best. Not, I should say, in the way that makes it easiest for Kevin, but in the way that optimizes his learning and takeaways in the course. Learning is collaborative and social. Our esteemed Dan Brown said that real life learning inevitably takes place in a social context when such setting is a classroom. I think we do a pretty good job of helping people feel connected in online environments. We can do a better job. And so a platform can have a whole lot to say about that. We're going to use evidence-based guidance whenever it's possible. Carl Sagan, my ultimate favorite. There are many hypotheses in science which are wrong. That's perfectly all right. There are the apertures to finding out what's right. Science is a self-correcting process. When we talk about an evidence-driven ILP, we're talking about one that can self-correct, which is an engineering feat in itself. To be accepted, new ideas must survive the most rigorous standards of evidence and scrutiny. Learning should be active and engaging. Mark Twain said, if you hold a cat by the tail, you learn things you cannot learn any other way. So my PhD is in educational leadership. I'll never forget them telling me that when you become a principal, you're going to have to build a school budget. That's when I almost changed my major. But once I got into it, I realized this is cool. This is very driven by our mission. What if that budget actually came from a real school and it was just very, very relevant and also rigorous for us? So the idea here is that it should be engaging in the sense that it has real life meaning for you. We all get that. And content should be contextual and relevant. Learning in context is paying attention to the interaction and intersection among people, tools, and context within a learning situation. So that's what we aim for. Anne Brown left us with this design experimentation graphic, and I'll just talk a little bit about what it means for us. So the individualized learning platform gives and it gets, and it's, of course, a garbage in, garbage out platform. We're building it based on contributions from learning theory, from people like Anne Brown and other very, very well-supported theorists. Instructional strategies come both from the faculty, but there are also some built in and baked into the platform. Here is the important part in the upper right-hand corner. The inputs that go in are the learner DNA, all of the things we talked about, Kevin's learning attributes, if you will. The teacher DNA. So matching those up, the one course I got an A- in my master's program was statistics. And I don't blame statistics. It was my professor. We could not see eye to eye. And I'm a good student. So I really believed that had I had a different instructor who took more time to understand my style, I would have gotten that A. But it's a good example, and it's a lifelong lesson of teacher DNA and sort of learner DNA being matched up. And if you can't match them up, if that's outside of your locus of control, you can at least give faculty members a really clear understanding of how students learn. So as you can see, we're really talking about moving from what they need to know and how we push that out to them in an online platform to the what on top of the how students learn. And that's really the thrust of this. And then, of course, we've got this intelligence engine that we talked about before, the adaptive learning engine, that both provides guidance to the learning platform and the humans that interact with it, and also pulls back out signals, both correcting itself and also providing data for better self-awareness among learners, faculty, deans, the provost, and people like Mike Sharkey and me who work on improving the system overall. We talked a little bit before about the Learning Genome Project and the absolute critical nature of understanding as much as we can about learners, both from what they tell us and what they do and what kinds of data the system collects about them. Demographics is obviously where we all begin. The question in your mind probably is, well, what do you do with all that stuff once you know it? Your domain-specific knowledge and skills, how much do you know? What are the pieces that are missing in the domain that will stymie you, like if you can't subtract or you can't carry the one, you're not going to do well in long division, right? So we need to be able to understand that about you through a variety of different kinds of assessments that don't kill you. Behaviors and interactions with the system can tell us a whole lot. So if I notice through data collection that Kevin spends a lot more time in his learning team than he does in the whole class discussion, I know something about his need to be in a social environment as he learns. Can I change his experience because I know that? Sure. See, I might even assign him to a course with learners who also have that tendency. So that's certainly within our power, but we have to know it first. And we also need to provide Kevin with some options. I don't want to make an assumption that I'm not sure about. Maybe I'll ask him directly, do you prefer to be in a team than to operate individually? Cognitive DNA, I've sort of broken out here a couple of ideas there. Your co-native attributes. So what motivates you? Are you struggling to be motivated? Are you resistant because you've got the technology, it matters, you know, you're not really proficient in office products? Are you anxious about this whole online thing? Is the pace too fast and is it making you react in a way that is averse to achieving your learning goals? Those things are critically important. We all know that. But how we measure them is not only a challenge, but a very important area for us to explore. Cognitive attributes, we know what they are. Forgetting the domain now, metacognitive ability, reasoning, critical reasoning, information literacy. If all of your sources say Wikipedia, we need to talk about that. You get the idea there. Some people's reading comprehension levels will be static for, you know, the early part of their educational experience, and that matters a whole lot. Maybe we need to vary the text we give you, or give you a podcast or some other way to capture the material. This is not to say that reading comprehension should not improve throughout a program. It just means that we don't want those cognitive limitations to stand in your way of learning economics. Your affective attributes, how open are you to this? Does this feed your high need for achievement working in this course room? Or does it just really put you in a bad mood every time you log in? We need to know that. There are things that we can do to support. So now getting into the specifics of the platform and the sort of core tenets that we're using to design it. Obviously, it needs to be as highly flexible as possible. But if you start to think about platforms outside of the domain of education, you can kind of get some examples. Supporting a wide variety of experiences. Netflix. Right? We all have different experiences. They're MySpace, Facebook. All of those provide a wide variety of types of experiences. Content modalities, different ways of delivering. So that means that we have to step out of the zone of you're going to get your textbook in a PDF document and start thinking about other ways to deliver the content and send instructional designers into gray hair. We talked about before it being highly open and extensible, the ability to bring in third-party applications that do exactly what we're trying to say, which is diversify the content and provide more opportunities for those aha moments for students. It's highly engaging, real experiences, it's data-driven, measuring every single interaction that's possible. We are very actively engaged in discussion around the ethical implications of that. What does it mean to hyper-personalize, demonstrating that you know a whole lot about me? I've had experiences online where I've received ads that I thought, oh my gosh, I was sort of embarrassed. What does the system think it knows about me? So there's certainly a feeling that something is watching. So we need to be really careful about that. And I just want to be upfront that it's a very important consideration that we're spending a lot of time thinking about. Data-driven and machine-driven. This is where I was talking about modeling learners, where we categorize students based on certain attributes. Kevin is going to fall into a whole bunch of different categories, co-native categories, cognitive categories. And so we'll be modeling him in this complex combination or composite of those categories so that when there are options, we can either present them to him and he selects, or we can make pre-selections that we've seen through his behavior he likes. If every time he picks a podcast in the first four courses of his program, we know something about him. He's had video choices, online gaming choices, simulation choices for the delivery of content, but he always picks a podcast. So that's very helpful for us. So our instructional designers need to know that. Kevin's faculty members need to know that. And we need to know that about him so that we can maximize those options for people that fall in his category and the machine can learn. When we talk about self-correction of the system, we're really talking about it being science-driven. We're looking for, we've cognitive scientists and other, you know, mathematicians building predictive models around what students are doing. And so we're trying to confirm or disconfirm and refigure those models so that we can understand real causal relationships in learning. And where better than an online platform to do that? That's the sort of part of what we will be publishing on once we have enough evidence to really support our approach. Human-driven is an important thing. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of weeks ago that like 10 of my friends sent me. And I'm a faculty member. I've been an educator for 22 years now. And so I do not think that faculty members can be replaced by these fantastic learning platforms. But I was made really aware, actually, in a conversation that Mike Sharkey and I and others have had, where I said, no, it's not possible. You can just augment what the faculty member is doing. But you know, as much as I've cared about differentiating instruction for students, among all of the different controversies in educational research, that is one that's supported by virtually everybody. We do better when learning is targeted for us. Learning experiences are very personal. But humans cannot, to scale, and this is our challenge, right, with hundreds of thousands of students, humans cannot, to scale, differentiate and personalize. Humans can't learn all they need to know about Kevin in 7 weeks or whatever, however long the course is. This whole idea is a really big question. How do the humans involved in building the platform and serving Kevin personally, how do they interact with the system? What kinds of data products can Mike Sharkey develop so that faculty members know as absolutely much about the student as they can so that they can bring in the human element and serve and differentiate and just understand Kevin? This is a field for a lot more exploration, and we'll have to be very careful. Adam is going to need to be thinking about how faculty members are trained to use this. Kind of want to give you a general sense for what the platform features may look like. Some of them are in place and some of them are in development. Some of them are just in conception at the moment. One example, learning is a personal journey. Maybe you have a personal remediation plan. At the end of Kevin and my first week, we'll take a little test and we'll get a personalized study plan. Learning is collaborative and social. I used to live in Japan. I did an online master's degree while I was abroad, 14 hours away from everybody else who was doing it. I would go online and there was never anyone there, not the faculty members. So the asynchronous nature of it was a little bit disenfranchising for me. So just imagine a social network that encompasses tens of thousands of students, some of which will be online when you're there, and all have expressed interest in particular domains of economics or what have you. So really building that very comprehensive social network, which we have already launched. It's called Phoenix Connect. And I thought that there were upwards of 10,000 participants at this point in the School of Business. 180,000, forgive me. So imagine 180,000 MBA students in a social network where their specialty divides them into groups of particular interest. And many of these people are already in fields where they're dynamic contributors to the content of courses that they're taking. So, you know, none of my 15 classmates are online. No problem. I can consult with some other people in real time in a social network that looks very much like the ones that you're a part of. So it's a very exciting innovation. Guidance should be evidence-based. We talked about building a priori models that we confirm or rebuild based on evidence because we do have such a sizable sample from which to draw, and a stratified one that I think will really yield a lot of very interesting insights that we certainly hope to publish. Lots and lots of applications, some of which I hope that we haven't even thought of yet. Challenges. There are a lot. So the technology, just the scale, just one of the challenges that came before what we were doing is there was a one-size-fits-all approach. And that's a challenge in the sense that it's not the best way. It's not the optimal way that we can learn. Although it's been very effective for hundreds of thousands of students, we can do it better by leveraging some of the tools that are out there and that are being executed very well in other industries. We're looking at a lot of open source materials that we're stitching together with a very, very adept team of engineers and designers and product managers. Cost. It's a biggie. Resistance to change, you know, we're getting there. We've done this so well for so long. Why do it differently? I think Adam articulated well why we're doing it differently, because it's possible now. The human versus machine perception, you know, as a faculty member, of course, I think I do a pretty darn good job with just my basic discussion forum, right? But if you're a faculty member, just imagine the potential. And then the gatekeepers. I think that there's really no downside of this. What can we say to the Higher Learning Commission about the very specific ways that we've measure learning outcomes in our institution? It's going to be a very, very powerful way of reporting and thus really focusing on continuous improvement and just holding a mirror up before ourselves with really raw data. What does all this mean? It's personal. It's collaborative. We're basing all of this on evidence and seeking new evidence and answers to questions that I think we all have about learning on online and making it as contextual and relevant as we can for our learners. Building this adaptive learning engine that truly hyper-personalizes. You know, K through 12 needs this too, but we're in a perfect position to get there because we have the research chops to get us there and to do it right. Always looking at and examining data, giving it to our learners, giving it to our faculty in very rich ways using dashboards and data marts and true self-awareness. When a learner knows how they're doing from moment to moment, they're very, very motivated to do even better. And obviously, that the platforms be able to adapt based on results. So this is a constitution that could be amended. Today, we're really deeply in the literature. We're having lots of rich discussions with organizations who are doing parts of this, and it's been interesting to see how the different pieces can stitch together. We're looking at what other industries are doing and how they're finding success by individualizing what strategies they're using. We're building this thing. The platform is in the midst of being structured. You can click around a little bit. And we're really collaborating with other practitioners to try to see how we can crowdsource some of the thinking on this, because we think it'll be a service to a lot of entities out there and to education in general. Thank you very much.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.